Greetings, everybody around the world. It's time once again for Ancient Aliens Radio. This is the dedicated radio show for the cast of Ancient Aliens. Here we interview authors and researchers as an ongoing investigation into the ancient alien theory. Don't forget to like us on Facebook or subscribe to the YouTube channel, Ancient Aliens Radio.
So let me tell you about today's guests, Robert Bovall, best-selling author of The Orion Mystery and probably most famous for that book. He's born in Alexandria, Egypt in 1948. His father was Belgian and his mother was Maltese Italian. In 1967, he settled in England where he continued to his studies. 1973, he graduated from the University of the South Bank in London with a higher national diploma in building management and technology. He then worked as a construction engineer in Oman, Sudan, Iran, Guinea, Saudi Arabia, France, Australia, and England. 1994, he published his first book on ancient Egypt, The Orion Mystery, which was the number one Sunday Times bestseller and has since been translated into more than 25 languages. He's since published a further 7 books, including The Message of the Sphinx, The Egypt Code, Black Genesis, co-authored with Thomas Brophy, PhD physicist from San Diego. His 2011 book, The Master Game, was co-authored with Graham Hancock. Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, The Conspiracy to Suppress the Voice of Ancient Egypt was published in 2012, which we're going to talk about today in the first half of the show. His discoveries and theories have been the subject of dozens of TV documentaries on many channels, including BBC, ZDF, France, A3, ABC, NBC, Fox TV, History Channel, Discovery Channel, and RAI Italia. Bovall speaks 4 languages, English, French, Italian, and Arabic, and is presently learning Spanish. He has 2 children who lives in England, and he and his wife, Michelle, live in southern Spain. Wow. Welcome, Robert. What an intro that is.
Yes, I didn't know I had done all these things. I keep forgetting.
Man, and I didn't know you'd speak 4 languages, Robert, and on to a 5th next.
Yes, I do. In fact, my mother tongue is French. I was brought up in a French-speaking family in Egypt. Perhaps I should tell you a little bit more about this background, because...
Please do, Robert, please do.
Yeah, something turned up not long ago that changed the whole perspective of my origins in Egypt.
Oh.
What I discovered, and you'll understand in a minute, there were 2 families that came from Syria in the city of Aleppo. Aleppo is very much in the news these days because of the Syrian war. There were Christian families, but Syrian in origins, in nationality, and they came to Cairo. And amazingly, this was the year 1750. We're talking something like 40 years or so before the invasion, before the invasion of Napoleon and the beginning of modern Egypt. So when these families came to Egypt, now their names is very interesting because, again, you'll see the point. One family was called the Siufis. It can have several meanings, but one of the most accepted meanings, it means the sword. Why they were called the sword is not so clear, but anyway. And the other family, it was called the Tutungis. There are still today very prominent families in Egypt, in the Cairo region. In fact, there is a region in greater Cairo called Tutungi. So having said this scene, sometime in 1786, so we're something like 15 years before the coming of Napoleon, in Cairo. Now, Cairo was Egypt, and Cairo was ruled by a rather odd feudal system known as the Mamelukes. The Mamelukes were, well, I don't want to go too much into that, but the Mamelukes were imported slaves from the Macedonian and Circassian regions, and became the rulers of Egypt. They're very, very orthodox. It's very odd for me to think that these 2 families were there at that time, because it was a very Islamic, very repressed, very authoritarian, and very feudal. In any case, one member of this family, the Siufis, they had a son. And I don't know how many children they had, but they had one son called Joseph. And the other family, Tutungi, had a girl called Teresa. This is very interesting, because when Napoleon came, they were both 15 years old. I'm not sure if they knew each other. The boy got recruited in the Napoleonic army, probably because he was Christian. When Napoleon had to evacuate, when the French army was evacuated 3 years later after the defeat by the British in 1801. These two children were kind of taken along with the whole evacuation and found themselves in France. They either knew each other or met during the evacuation, and a few years later got married in France. They never returned to Egypt, but they had many children, and many of them are still in France, and they created a whole dynasty there. But one of them, called Jean-Baptiste, I've got all these names now because I did a huge research, Jean-Baptiste came to Alexandria at the age of 40, returned, in other words, to Egypt, and met an Italian woman whom he married, much younger than him, and they had 10 children. One of them was my grandmother. She married a Belgian. They had my father, was a single child, and he married a Maltese, and they had me. So that's the story. So I've realized that I've got a big dose of Syrian blood. There you are.
There we go. And kind of just as an intro into the book, then, Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, you go into that time period in the book, Robert. I guess that's why you were doing the research too?
Not really. I mean, I found this out while I was writing Breaking the Mirror of Heaven with Ahmed Osman, by the way, I should say.
Sorry, the co-author, Ahmed Osman, yeah?
Yes, Ahmed Osman. Let me introduce him briefly. Ahmed Osman is an Egyptian journalist who is now in his late 60s. He left Egypt because of the problems that we have today, which existed at the time he left. He left in the early 60s. He was actually a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. But repudiated that after realizing what they were all about and left Egypt, settled in England. He lives in London now. He's been living in London for the last 50 years and has become an author. He's well known for his books on the links between Moses and Akhenaten and...
I think I've read that book.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. It's called Strangers in the Valley of the Kings, and he's written... His last book, I think, was called Akhenaten and Moses.
That's the one I read.
Right. And we've known each other for a long time, both being from the Egyptian diaspora. Interestingly, I come from that background, as you've just heard, of a Christian background. And he comes from a Muslim background. And so we both together really understand the ins and outs of this Egyptian problem.
The dynamics, yeah, definitely.
Yes, and perhaps I should make a little promotion here. We've just been contracted to write a sequel to Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, yes.
Beautiful.
And it's called Removing the Veil.
Right.
So this will be more to do with, I don't want to get into that because...
Well, just for the listeners, Robert, let me just firstly say like that Breaking the Mirror of Heaven is a very important book, I think, and it needed to be wrote. And it's definitely, you know, a window into what happened really, you know, in Egypt, right down to the diplomatics of what goes on in archaeology to, you know, it's just an important, incredible book. It's dynamite now. It's dynamite, but it's,
well,
it's true. It's true and it's accurate and it's tackling the truth.
We wanted to write this book mainly because of what had happened in Egypt and particularly after the so-called revolution of 2 years ago. And of course, because, and as you probably realize with this book, because of a long, long feud with the antiquity department, run by that famous ex-minister Zahi Hawass. So both myself and Ahmed Osman had personal battles with this man for many, many years, and we were and still are regarded by him as his nemesis.
Enemies.
Oh yeah, particularly me. And so it was the right combination for not just a Muslim man living outside Egypt, and me as a Christian, although I don't practice it, and getting together and analyzing the whole landscape, the historical landscape of modern Egypt, which runs, of course, there are two things that run together: is the emergence and evolution of modern Egypt, hence the politics, if you want. And on the other hand, the evolution, the formation and evolution of the antiquity departments. They kind of run parallel and crisscross themselves several times in the last 200 years. So we decided to put all this in a book and to give the right vision of what really happened rather than what is being flaunted as propaganda and whole confusion. It's very important that, well, at least from the antiquities viewpoint, we understand the mess that was created there and the dangers that are in front of us.
You know, I was in my middle 30s. I'm in my middle 30s now, Robert. And when I was in my middle teens, I was picking up books by yourself, Hancock, Bovall, and any, spiritually John Anthony West as well. And I loved Ancient Egypt. And here was this new alternative knowledge coming out. And this, obviously, from the theory that you, the Orion spelt, and, you know, there's been a world and a wealth of information since that. But I remember at the same time this Zahi Hawass fiasco. And so I know about the Zahi Hawass thing just because I had read the books. But like, I mean, probably back then he hadn't been as notorious as he is nowadays. But I could see his notoriety develop alongside the alternative knowledge develop. Mm-hmm. And it was almost a fiasco in a way. I mean, because the people in the alternative knowledge community, you know, he distanced himself in a way to yes, he had like the news channels and the Discovery and the Geographics on his side. And we'll get into some of that and the dynamics. But, you know, he didn't do himself any favors in for Egyptological perspective, like, you know.
Yes. I think it's important to realize something that is difficult for those who did not experience the evolution of modern Egypt, and particularly since the first revolution. The first revolution, really, when everything changed in Egypt, was in 1952. I was still in Egypt. Well, I was a young child in Egypt. And basically, what happened was that the army, and surprisingly again, the army took over what was really a monarchy, but very much a feudal system. Egypt was run by a royal family. The last king was King Farouk, the famous King Farouk. And below him was this huge feudal lords that practically owned Egypt, literally. They owned the land, they owned the agriculture. It was run by these feudal lords. They were called the pashas. Now, these pashas, estimated about 3,000 of them, used the country as their own property and used the people as their own servants. I mean, citizens were servants in their own country. You know, they would, as an example, when the Suez Canal was being excavated, the Khedive at the time, Khedive Ismail, ordered the population to go and work as slaves. I mean, it's kind of incredible.
Cheap labor force, eh?
Yes, and it's estimated 20,000 of them died in this terrible heat digging this canal. So, you know, the Egyptians were very much a subdued, repressed, controlled, manipulated, servile people in their own land. So it reached a point where things were so bad that they had this revolution, and frankly everybody was in ecstatics. Not so much people like my parents, because unfortunately this revolution took a kind of anti-Western approach, because of course many of the so-called Westerners living in Egypt, a bit like in India during the colonial days, although born in Egypt and in my case with many generations going in Egypt, were siding with these feudal lords. I mean, everybody was, the elite was running the country. So, of course, they took the backlash as well. Although I came from a very modest family. My father was a normal employee in the government. So, really what happened is that the Egyptians had that huge opportunity to become what they hope to become now. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, two things occurred. I was having a long discussion, by the way, just before you called.
Oh.
with the Egyptologist David Roll. You know David Roll?
I know the name. I can't place it.
Yeah, he wrote The Test of Time, and he's well known for his chronological books.
Sure.
David lives in Spain, so we had this long, long talk because we're following the events going on in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come to the point where we both agree on something rather interesting to know. But however, having said this, the Egyptians finally had that, you know, I remember the population, all these people that were living in poverty and living repressed and did not own land. So the people who took over the army, and of course, being led by the extremely charismatic president Gamal Abdel Nasser, the British know him very well because he caused several wars involving the British. Gamal Abdel Nasser was a very charismatic man. He was really a breed that it needs to be understood in Egypt. Although, yes, he was very into this vision of a new Egypt, a liberated Egypt, and installing social reform and so forth. He nonetheless, I think it's almost genetic. He was one of these almost pharaonic rulers. And he became very, very autocratic. He became very, very domineering. I mean, he was revered as a god in Egypt after a few years after the revolution. And rather than get their freedom and this huge social reform, they got a huge autocrat who led them finally into the disastrous war of 1967, the famous Six-Day War. But I'm saying this because Nasser represents and still does represents that new Egyptian who came from rags to riches, or rather from nothing to a huge position of power. He was the model, if you like, of people like Hawass. Hawass is of the same generation, and Hawass would look upon Gamal Abdel Nasser as a hero, as a man who confronted the Western powers and used his authority and his charisma. So that's what Hawass used as a model, yes. And we kind of expose this in the book. Hawass, same thing, like Nasser, came from a very small village and grew up with this kind of hang up, you know, this complex of being an Egyptian who comes from a small village, who is held back, who is going to make it, you know. And he did, you know, he kind of went to university and fought his way through and modeled himself in the image of this hero. So Hawass, that's Hawass really. And to him, this is how one becomes in a position of authority, like Mubarak. You know, Mubarak is, they used to call him the Pharaoh, you know, and Hawass was doing the same thing. So this is the kind of individual. He even looked like Gamal Abdel Nasser a little bit, you know, this sort of big physical, and he was, his attitude to administer and to manage the antiquities department was very much pharaonic. I mean,
domination, really.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I had terrible fights with this man. I mean, I tell you,
he's definitely volatile, Robert. He's a volatile individual.
You know, I met Hawass. I actually physically met Hawass in 1994.
Right.
So by that time, he had become the director of the Giza necropolis. He was not yet in full authority of the antiquities. But being the director of the Giza necropolis gave him a lot of authority, and especially with the rest of the world, because really Giza is the big archaeological site, and everybody wants to come and get concessions and get exclusivity and get permits and do documentaries. So he was very much sought after. And he was very clever, and you probably saw this in the book. He was very clever to develop a close relationship with the Minister of Culture.
Yes, yes.
Because the Minister of Culture, this is something, again, we need
it's to... It's Hosni, isn't it? Farouk Hosni.
Farouk Hosni, yes, who is now in house arrest in Egypt. But Farouk Hosni was, in fact, in charge of the antiquities, even though he was the Minister of Culture. Because there was no Ministry of Antiquities. The antiquities were run by a so-called, Well, first it was called the Egyptian Antiquity Organization, the EAO, and it was converted to the Supreme Council of Antiquities under the aegis, under the authority of the Ministry of Culture. So, in other words, Farouk Hosni was the boss. But there was, of course, a chairman or a general secretary, as you used to call him, of the Supreme Council of Antiquities. This chairman, at the time, Mohammed Ibrahim, was in constant feud with Farouk Hosni. Now, the allegiance of Hawass should have been towards his superior, the chairman of the Supreme Council. But Hawass was very clever. He became very, very buddies, very close buddies with the Minister of Culture, Farouk Hosni. This is well known in Egypt. And therefore, by being protected by Farouk Hosni, who was himself very, very close to Suzanne Mubarak and the presidential family, Hawass felt like he could run the antiquities, even though he was not the boss, which caused a huge, huge feud between him and the chairman of the antiquities, Mohammed Ibrahim.
Fuel to the fire, as they say, Robert. He was adding fuel to the fire.
Well, they were both, he and Farouk Hosni and Hawass were both plotting to get this chairman out, and they did. And I was present. This is when I met Zahi Hawass, actually, in 94, when all this was about to happen. And, Hawass was a bit of a different man in those days. I mean, he was authoritative, but he was a bit more subdued. And, I met him on the occasion of the huge, scandal that had erupted involving the so-called, Gantenbrink exploration. You remember when?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to go on a roll on this, so you'll have to stop me if you want to ask me other questions.
Well, let's talk about some of the, I mean, the Gantenbrink's door with this robot. I mean, and then, you know, this is what Zahi would do. He just went in and shut the operation down and went and closed all the doors and, you know.
Literally.
How long was it before then that the other shaft got explored? A number of years.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm glad you brought this up because this is when finally the true Zahi came out. Let me go back in time. We're now roughly around early 93.
Yeah.
Something rather odd happened is that, like I said, there was this feud building up between Hawass and his boss, the chairman of antiquities, Mohammed Ibrahim. But by as fate would have it, there was a visit to Egypt and to the Giza Necropolis by the ex-president of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, who had requested to the Minister of Culture if he could have a private visit at the pyramid. Of course, they would not deny him this. Now, what the Minister of Culture did is rather than inform the chairman, as he should have done, the chairman of the antiquities, Mohammed Ibrahim, he informed Hawass. Ignored the chairman completely. So Hawass, very excitedly, said, yeah, let me prepare the arrival. And Hawass took the decision to bring out newly discovered statues, small statues, but very precious. They were from the pyramid age, to put them on a table in front of the Sphinx and show them to Muammar Gaddafi. Well, there's a very big confusion as to what exactly happened, but two of these statues disappeared.
Right. The mystery,
and,
yeah,
big mystery. There's been, of course, accusations, maybe right, maybe wrong, that they were actually given by Hawass as a present to Muammar Gaddafi. In any case, of course, the antiquity chairman went bananas. First, because he wasn't informed. And two, is that the statue disappeared and the Hawass did not have the authority, the legal authority, to bring out the statues. He needed to get a written permission from the chairman. So this gave the opportunity of the chairman to suspend Hawass. He wanted to fire him, but he suspended. And Hawass was very, very worried because on something like this, you go in jail in Egypt. And this is a very serious offense. And so he literally ran away from the country. He went to America for a while and ducked. And the chairman was very pleased. He got rid of his nemesis. What they didn't expect is for the Minister of Culture to turn against this chairman and bring Hawass back. And who got fired was the chairman. So that's how Hawass got his opportunity to become the boss.
Wow, what an entrance there.
The whole conundrum of hanky-panky going on.
Fiasco.
So Hawass became in authority, but still not the chairman. The reason, although the Minister of Culture, Farouk Hosni, wanted him to become, he could not become chairman for one specific reason. He did not have the credentials that are necessary legally to become chairman. Mm-hmm. So there was all this thing about him getting a PhD and coming up with a PhD in America and all this business. Meanwhile, the chairmanship was given to various people, Nureddin, whom I met myself. Now, this is where the Gantabrik story explodes. Hawass is in America. He has been suspended. But before he was suspended, and when he was still in control of the Giza Necropolis, had given permission to Rudolf Gantabrik,
yes,
who was working under the aegis of the German Institute. And I happened to meet Rudolf. I'm not going to go into the details here, but I happened to meet Rudolf some 2 weeks before he made the discovery of the door. I met him. I was actually introduced to him by Professor Edwards, who wanted to know what was going on. The Germans were exploring hush-hush. We heard there was some sort of exploration in the shafts. I was very interested, of course, because of my theories. And so one thing led to another, and I got a very high-level introduction to the German Institute by Professor Edwards, who was now retired. He was the ex-curator of the British Museum Egyptian Department. Mm-hmm. And there I go with this introduction, and finally I meet Rudolf. I met him at an hotel outside near the pyramids, and he told me that he had brought this famous machine, this famous robot, and he was about to start the exploration of the southern shaft. And I said, well, fine, you know, let me know what you find. And there's a kind of joke here, because I know the story so well. So
yeah.
This happened to be the 7th of March when he started, 93. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to England. I was living in England at the time. And suddenly it went blank. Didn't hear from Rudolf at all. So I called the German Institute saying, what's happened? He was exploring the shaft. And they were being very cagey and saying, well, he's left the country. And he had given me his number in Munich.
Sure.
And I called him up, and he immediately answered. And I said, what happened? You know, and he said, well, you know, I've had this big fight with Zahi, who has now returned from his exile in America. And I took my machine and I took my films. And by the way, Robert, I found the door at the end of the shaft.
Wow.
So I said, you did what? And he said, the door, you know, and there's a little door at the end of the shaft. And I said, come on. I mean, you know, you're sure? Yes, I'm sure. And I've got a film about it. And then I remember, as I was talking to him, I was looking at my wall, and there was a calendar, and it said the 1st of April. So I thought, come on, you're cracking it. Yes, come off it. You know, Rudolf said, no, it's true. And he said, okay, I tell you what, I'm going to send you the video. In those days, they had this big VHS films. You know? So he said, okay, I'll put it with the DHL and you'll get it tomorrow. And he sure did, you know. I'll never forget this. I actually went to collect it at the DHL office because I couldn't wait to see this thing.
Sitting on the edge of your seat, probably watching that video. Right?
Oh, yeah. I felt it was Aidan Gilbert with me. There you are. And I called Aidan, who was at the time co-authoring the Orion Mystery with me. I said, come over, you know, and I'm going to collect this film and let's see it. And sure enough, you know, there was this robot climbing the shaft and reached this little door. And I thought, my God, I mean, what is this, you know? I mean, it sounds very banal now, but let me tell you, it was a huge, huge excitement at the time. I mean, a door inside a great pyramid and this is inside the shaft. So I immediately called Professor Edwards. And I said, listen, you're not going to believe this, but I've got a tape from Rudolf. And he was very confused. How come you got the tape? You know, what happened to him? And where is the German Institute? And why are the Egyptians talking about it? I have no idea. This seems to have been a problem, political problem. And Rudolf sent me the tape. So anyway, there we he said, well, here, bring it over. You know, and so I said, okay, well, he said, but I don't have a TV. He didn't have a VHS player.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said, okay, well, we bring ours, you know, and Adrian and I took the car and we drove there immediately with the VHS. We plugged it in, and I remember that scene, and Professor Edwards was calmly, we were in his home and he was calmly waiting. And I must say, you know, he passed away in 2006.
Sure.
He passed away in 1996, a few years later. But anyway, at the time he was rather old and he had a very bad eyesight. So he had this huge magnifying glass that he used to read with. So we played this tape. And, you know, he said, what's happening? So I had to describe to him, you know, because he couldn't see us. So I said, well, this is robot climbing up the shaft and, you know, and it's all dark. And, you know, finally we got to the door. He said, what is it? I said, well, it's illuminating this strange looking small trap door, you know, with metal handles. And I remember his wife, who also passed away, was next to him, and he suddenly jumped. Now you got to see this 85-year-old man jumping with this magnifying glass on the television screen and looked at that door. And I'll never forget this. He was silent for about a minute or maybe more, and he looked at it and looked at it, and he said, "Robert, this is incredible. Who knows about this?" So I said, well, I'm very confused. I think
just us.
Just us. You know? So he said, call Dr. Jaromir Malek immediately at Oxford. So we called Jaromir Malek, whom I knew, before vaguely. You know, I had met him a couple of times, and John Baines was the professor then. They're both retired, I think. And they said, bring it over. No, it's getting very confusing. You guys come along, yeah? So there we are with these top Egyptologists, you know, Professor Edwards and Professor Jaromir Malek looking at this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's asking, you know, well, how come the Egyptians haven't announced it? I mean, it's incredible because we're now sort of like 2 weeks after the discovery. And it's there. I mean, it's, you know, who's going to announce this? So I phoned Rudolf and I said, what do you want to do? And he said, look, well, I must say there was a confusing moment, and Rudolf was not very clear on this, but the real issue was that he was still under legal obligation to the German Institute, who themselves were under legal obligation to the Antiquity Department in Egypt to obtain permission to reveal this discovery, or any discovery. But Rudolf then hinted, he said, well, Robert, you don't work for anybody, do you? So I said, no. He said, well,
a little hint.
Yeah, you can do what you want. So I got the hint. And I actually asked Professor Edwards, what do we do? And he said, well, look, I mean, this has to be announced because nobody will understand how it's been held for so long.
It's too important, Robert.
Well, yeah, I mean, this, and it's still not clear what's behind these doors, you know, and it's, let's remember, this is the Great Pyramid. I mean, this is the monument of monuments.
The biggest enigma on the planet, I think, if, you know, for me,
well,
I'm an engineer, I'm from an engineering background and a science background, Robert. It's one of the biggest enigmas for me, anyway, as a student of engineering.
It is, yes. I mean, it's one of the most extraordinary monuments. Maybe I should say this as an aside. I mean, I've lived, well, I grew up in Egypt, but in more recent times, I lived literally outside the Great Pyramid from 2006 to 2008. I had an apartment. I decided to write one of my books, the Egypt Code, and I rented an apartment literally opposite the Great Pyramid. I mean, you know, I used to look outside the window and there it was, you know.
Beautiful.
And having said this, you know, and even though, like you, I'm from an engineering background, it is a baffling monument. I mean, you, especially if you live next to it, it's just annoys you because it's so mysterious. It's just one of those things, you know, you're provoked all the time to try and explain it. And, but having said this, of course, finding anything in the Great Pyramid, let alone a door at the end of a shaft, was an incredible, exciting possibility of something of major importance. So
I think the public at the time, though, Robert, the public at the time thought there was a lot of red tape involved, but I wouldn't call it red tape. It was like people influencing events. It wasn't like, you know, legal red tape. I mean, there was like...
No. You're absolutely right. But what it was, let's call it spade a spade, as we say. What it was is that this discovery was made by somebody totally from the outside of Egyptology. I mean, Rudolf Gantbrick had absolutely nothing to do with Egyptology before he went to explore the shaft. He was, and still is, a robotics engineer who had the bright idea of saying, well, like everybody else, he had read about the pyramid and the shafts and said, it's amazing that nobody bothered to explore these shafts. We have the technology now. And one thing led to another. The luck, I suppose, was when he got the idea, the German Archaeological Institute had been asked by the Egyptian authorities to devise a ventilation system using those shafts for the Great Pyramid. So Rudolf came at the right time. He was just at the right time, at the right place, saying, well, look, I can do all this ventilation for you. I can pay for it. I can get sponsors if you would allow me to explore these shafts. And they said, well, yeah, go ahead. Well, what's amazing is that it shows you the strange, I mean, I don't know how to call it, the sort of catatonic, boring lack of curiosity, because these shafts were there, and we've known they were there since 1872.
What do you think of Chris Dunn's theory, just on the sideline then, Robert?
Mm.
it's far-reaching, I know that. Like, it's a very...
No. You see, I mean, Chris...
I know you've got your own theory for the shafts too, so...
Well, one has to place a theory in a proper context. And Chris is an excellent tool maker, I mean, and machinist, and he knows a lot about how stones are cut, and that's his forte. And he has done a lot of interesting research on those lines. But he didn't, in my view, a lot of people ignore the context of this monument, and short of having something else.
Well, the angle the shafts point to and what they do, and I know.
Well, apart from that, but short of having anything else, we have the pyramid texts.
Yeah.
Which, although not in this monument, they are in pyramids that immediately follow the fourth dynasty. And we cannot ignore these, and the context is very clearly a metaphysical context. I mean, what needs to be understood is why they needed a physical monument to achieve a metaphysical objective, which was basically to have the spirit of the king become a star and travel to the afterlife in the sky. So, but that is the context, and the theory of the shafts aligned to the stars, the representation of Orion's belt on the ground being the destination of kings, dovetails into this context of the pyramid text. So, this is, I think, is where a lot of people are going in the wrong direction. Having said this, and I'm deviating a bit from the story of Gantenberg, but having said this, one has to say this as well. You know, is that the Great Pyramid, as it is well known, is devoid of any inscriptions. That's one of the great mysteries of the Great Pyramid and Fourth Dynasty pyramids, not just the Great Pyramid. They do not have inscriptions. Which is baffling, because we know that before and after their construction, the Egyptians not only knew how to write, but they were very prolific in their hieroglyphic writings. I mean, the pyramids of the Fifth Dynasty are loaded with texts, literally. And temples before or during the construction of the Giza pyramids are the mastabas and the temples of the tombs of nobles in the area are loaded with texts. So one has to ask the question is, why does it not contain texts? Until one reasons out that whoever designed this monument was expressing their ideologies in using another form of expression, which is astronomical mathematics. That is very interesting. That is very interesting, because it's as if they wanted to use what today we would call a universal language. You know, that seems to have been the objective of the design of this monument. Not so we've got to accept this. And Egyptologists are very, very reluctant to talk too much about this. There's no doubt that the Great Pyramid has mathematical factors that are very impressive. You know, we have the letter, the constants pi, the Fibonacci, the golden ratios, the perfection of the angles, which provide a radius to circumference correlation. We have then its absolute perfect astronomical alignment. We have stellar directions pointed. So we have all this. The monument is speaking in this universal form of language, which is exactly the language we would use today if we'd speak to an alien civilization, if you like. There's no points.
Just before we go back to Gantenbrink's door, because I know it was some years later before the other shaft was explored.
Yeah.
How do you feel now after all these years, Robert, on your Giza Orion theory and the impact that that's had even on other authors?
Well,
and the encouragement to go, because a lot of people have kind of, and the alternative knowledge community has really exploded, and you,
yes.
It all roads head back to you in a way, Robert, over that.
Well, not all, but I mean.
Well, I mean, even setting outside Egypt, I mean, myself included, I wrote a book on archaeoastronomy, and the whole idea of archaeoastronomy has blossomed as a subject because of, like, just even Egyptology.
Well, I don't want to blow my own trumpet.
Well, I know you don't, but I mean.
However, one thing about the Orion correlation theory that was and still is surprising to me is that once you point it out, it's very obvious.
It's very obvious, yes.
And therefore, why has it escaped attention when it was so obvious? I mean, it's not whether there is a correlation. This has always been my argument.
There's no decipherment needed, Robert. No,
exactly. I mean, all you have to do is look at the stars, look at the monuments on the ground, and there is a correlation. The question is whether that correlation was intended. Mm. And the circumstantial evidence that builds up to a favorable argument of being intended is the pyramid text. The king wants to go to this particular stars, the Orion stars.
Yeah.
There is the shaft. There is the names of pyramids and so forth.
They were obsessed with Orion constellation, like, so it's not out of context, exactly. It's not.
Yes. So the contextual evidence, the circumstantial evidence, leans very much in favor of a deliberate correlation. This changes everything, because then these monuments stop being...
Silence. They speak to us now.
Well, They say something rather odd, which is not easy to understand. They say that you can somehow create a celestial landscape on the ground, which has meaning. Now, this is a very difficult one to understand, and it took me many, many years, because yes, the correlation was there. Yes, it kind of made theological sense. You know, they kind of build a paradise on Earth and in a replica of the sky region they wanted to go. But it didn't quite satisfy me. I tell you why, because of the huge effort involved. I mean, they really went to a huge, huge effort to build these structures. So one has to take that into consideration, saying, well, what justified that effort? You know, because if you want to represent Orion on the ground, you don't have to go and build those huge pyramids and mathematical proportions and so forth. I mean, you can just write about them if you want, or put smaller monuments. So this has always been in the back of my mind, and it takes a while to realize that what you're looking at, and I'm going to use a word here, and I better say this in advance. It does get explained as best as one can explain it in a book I've just written, which is this book on the Vatican, by the way. Oddly enough, and the word I'm using is talismanic.
Ah, you had a book on talismans as well, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, with Hancock.
Yeah.
Because slowly, slowly, as you get more and more into this way of thinking, into the mind of the ancients, and as you begin to explore their monuments, and you try and figure out what was this mental state, you know, why were they doing all this?
That's what fascinates me the most, Robert, this perspective that they had. I'm a dreamer. I like to just dream and get captivated, and that's what captivates me the most, their symbology, their mindset, their perspective.
Yes, they understood something that we need to understand again. And that is the, for lack of better words, is talismanic science. The human mind does not think in words.
Mm.
We do not, words are very recent to the human condition.
Mm. You know, symbolic thought. They think it thinks in symbolic thought.
Yes, symbolism is an important element in this quote-unquote talismanic way of thinking. The mind sees and reasons and senses the world and interprets it with the brain. That's we're equipped with that. So we have our sensory equipment. We sight, hearing, touching, smelling, and we absorb literally all this information, and it's processed by the mind. And the mind gives it a meaning, tries to understand it. You know, that's what we are. We're a kind of living supercomputer, if you like.
Sure.
That collects information and processes it. So, but the processing is not what you and I are doing now. You know, we're desperately trying to use a basic form of communication, which is
putting
words into what is going on in there in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the mind is not doing that. The mind is building up vision, ideas, interpretations that we are trying to put into some sort of language.
Mm-hmm.
So they understood that the mind is receptive and analyzes and instructs itself in this manner. So one of the things that they believed in, and perhaps they weren't far wrong, is that the mind associates what's going on up there almost unconsciously. You know, we live in a culture that is totally alienated from looking at the cosmos. You know, we read about it, we see our television programs, but we're not really in it.
Yeah.
We don't associate ourselves to this vast
detachment. A detachment there, Robert. Yeah.
Yeah. Until you are exposed to it. And for incidentally, I'm deviating a bit here again, but I was exposed to it in many, many occasions, but more dramatically recently, a few years ago when we did an expedition in the Sahara.
Oh, for Nabda Playa.
Yes, and the Gilf Kibir, and we wrote a book. I wrote a book with Thomas Brophy called Black Genesis. And everybody was in this expedition because we spent a lot of time in the open desert and we're pondering on these issues. Is that you suddenly, your mind becomes more receptive, more connected to a cosmic environment. Especially in the desert, because there's very little on the ground.
Sure.
You know, you're there in this open, arid space. And at night, and even at daytime, but at night, you're more up there than down here, if you see what I mean. And you begin to think in those bigger terms. You begin to think and try and understand all this. You're trying to understand what's up there. Your mind becomes very integrated into a cosmological thinking. That's
like a giant TV screen, Robert. That's the way I like to look at it.
Correct. And I use the word cosmology because this is what it's about. Is the mind, it belongs to a cosmological environment. It isn't just sitting in an office. Mm. So having said this, the Egyptians are very much in this format of thinking. And they saw their land, they saw their lives, they saw their whole activity linked to the cosmological events. And they're not far wrong. In fact, they're absolutely right. You know, they belong to this environment. Now, it takes a while to get into this. And then as you get more and more into this, you begin to understand why they were doing all these things, why they built pyramids, why they moved around along their land, built temples here and there, is that they thought in those terms. They saw themselves as cosmopolitans, literally, as people of the cosmos. And, they were thinking in the right way. Which is, by the way, having said this, a bit of promotion here, is the book that I'm about to, well, I've just started it, to write with Ahmed Osman. We're reminding the Egyptians of today that they lived in a land that inspired this form of thinking. and still does. And unfortunately, they've been influenced by external forces, because that's what Christianity was for many centuries in Egypt. And unfortunately, that's what Islam is. Islam does not belong really to Egypt. Egypt had had a theological system that pre-existed Islam for thousands of years and lived in perfect harmony. This is the reminder that the ancient Egyptians were able to sustain a harmonious, creative, peaceful civilization for many, many thousands of years before they were injected by ideologies that weren't theirs and has produced this chaos.
Let's tie some of this together, Robert. So the Tahrir revolution of 2011, do you think that's now going to change? Are we going to get people that will be able to do new research? Because I'm tying this back with the idea of Gantenbink's door, and these guys don't have this ambition to go and do these discoveries. The chamber beneath the paws of the Sphinx. I know Shock's kind of hopeful now that something might change because the dynamics has changed. Zahi Awas is gone. That's good in a way. Is there going to be somebody else there to replace him now? I'm trying to tie some of this together, Robert.
Well, Egypt, as you probably see in the news, certainly the last few days, is in enormous turmoil. But one has to understand the root cause and what can fix this turmoil before anything can concretely happen, not just in antiquities, but in the economy, in the revival of Egyptian society, in getting it back on track. Egypt is not meant for this kind of ideologies. This is one thing rather unusual about Egypt as a land. It is a land that when is inhabited and under the aegis of a people who integrate themselves with this land. You don't need to, you don't need to go too far in history to actually see this. You know, the people who are in Cairo, and you presumably see this on television, you see on one hand the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood congregating and by the millions wanting something, which is radical Islam, really. They want Islamic law and so forth. And the others who think that they want something called democracy and so forth, and they're by the millions on the other side of town. But that's not the Egyptians. The Egyptians, all you have to do is drive out of Cairo immediately and you will see them. They live on the banks of the Nile. They still do the thing that they did thousands of years ago. And they live very peacefully. And the reason they are in that state of harmonious peace with their own land and themselves is because they are integrated to the activities of this land, to the geographical morphology, hydraulics, the Nile, and so forth.
Yeah, the lifeblood.
Exactly. So this is the problem. And what Ahmed Osman and I want to do is to remind them of this, you know, and so we're going through this huge, huge exploration, starting literally before there was even people in Egypt, and looking at the land. Egypt is a miracle of nature. Unlike many other countries, it only exists because of a river.
It's all about the river, isn't it? Yep.
Yes, and it's all about the cycles of this river, and it's all about the cycles of this river tied to the activities of the sky, the changing position of the sun, and so forth. And the people who grew up with this, who integrated to this, should reconnect to this way of thinking. This is what Egypt really is. You bring some external ideologies and it messes it up. So we're trying to sort of go through the whole process of examining the origins of Egypt, the way that people lived in Egypt, why they developed this wonderful vision of themselves. If you want to talk about liberal Egypt, it's ancient Egypt. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Egyptians were the
very liberal. Yeah.
Well, it may surprise a lot of people, but they were devoid of any religion. We keep talking about the ancient Egyptian religion. There was no such thing as an Egyptian ancient religion. They had what we would call today, because we don't have the right words, a natural theology. They associated their ideologies, their metaphysical ideologies, to nature. Which incidentally is what this world should do.
Freedom of expression in a way without the shackles of an organization.
Yes, I mean, there's no religious man-made doctrines and dogmas in ancient Egypt. They believed in a system of ruling they called Mat. Mat was a cosmological order that they adhere to, and basically it was the reverence for nature, the respect for nature, to nurture their own geographical environment. To an Egyptian, it would have been absolutely devastating to see what has happened to their country, where the Nile is exploited in the wrong way, and factories and so forth. So what I'm saying is that one needs to understand, not just for the modern Egyptians today, and for the prospects of hopefully having a more liberal approach to antiquities. But it has a universal message. You know, the whole world is going sort of off track, mainly because we do not apply this way of thinking, which is a natural theology, for lack of better words. We need to rethink ourselves in relationship to our own planet, to our own cosmological place.
The way the show is, Robert, you know, to show people we could take some good lessons from the past. We don't have to dwell on the past. We don't have to get stuck there looking at ancient history all the time. But there's lessons to be learned, Robert, you know, and certainly the ancient Egyptians, more than anything.
Exactly, because I'll put another word. Egypt, or rather ancient Egypt, is a model that we should look at. You know, we have tried several models. We have tried divine monarchies. We have tried socialism, communism, democracy. We're trying all sorts of things. But there we have it in the past, a model, another model that was based on natural theology. The way that human beings are supposed to live on a planet, live in along their environments. This is why ancient Egypt is very, very important. And I'm not suggesting we all go and wear kilts and start building pyramids.
Sure.
But it is the concept of it that we need to see ourselves in the correct manner. And I believe the ancient Egyptians did so. And the proof is in the pudding. We have a civilization, unlike any other civilization, that if left alone in this manner of thinking, flourished. Wonderful. I mean, we still have their stuff today. When you think that the pyramids are at least 5,000 years old and they're still there, we have their temples, we have their magnificent art that was something extraordinary, especially in the early stages. So we have a civilization that flourished, that intrigues us, that even draws us. I mean, people who come to Egypt are drawn by this. They kind of, it's very odd, because I take a lot of tours to Egypt. And it's very odd that they think, when people come, they can't explain, but they say, well, I don't know. I'm drawn to this place. I want to find out something. I'm not quite sure what it is. You know, I want to go and meditate in the temples. I want to see the pyramids. I want to go in the king's chamber. Well, what they really mean is that there is a kind of amnesia that is waking up. You know, they're beginning to sense that this was perhaps the right model. You know, this is when everything seemed to work.
Intellectually and philosophically appealing, I think.
It's a reminder.
I feel that too. And I've been there three occasions, Robin, and I've felt exactly that. I remember sitting there captivated on the balcony thinking about, and yeah, I felt a sense of loss for this empire that was once there. And I kind of, you know, I got disheartened, but then I looked to this civilization, and for me, it's actually helped me. I've got good answers to life and questions, like, you know. Perhaps that's why they did this, the embodiment of this natural theosophy in a way.
The civilization has gone, but the idea is still there.
Yeah.
And this is where it's very interesting. And it is there constantly reverberating with these monuments, you know, and it is that idea that needs to be brought back. And I'll put it in very simple words. We're creatures on a planet. I mean, it's as simple as that. And we've complicated it no end with a wrong perception about how to deal with our presence on this planet. You know, we need to rethink ourselves. You know, I talk to philosophers, I talk to cosmologists, and it seems very obvious to me that the human race is reaching critical mass here. We're in serious danger. And we need to rethink our position. And we're at a loss, but here we have a beautiful model of a people
who did wonderful things, Robert.
Who seem to have thought Sorry?
They did wonderful things. I mean, they left monuments there. Just we still drop our jaws in amazement.
Yes. What it means is that if people are living in a context that is perfectly suited for their nature, perfectly suited for their mental way of seeing themselves and the world, then they can produce wonderful things. They are inspired by their existence, and this is what you see in Egypt. You see this amazing expression of people who were clearly inspired. I mean, you don't go and build pyramids, you don't go and do statues like they did. I mean, you've been at the Cairo Museum.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, to carve a statue in basalt or in hard granite and bring it to the perfection that it is would require an enormous amount of inspiration, an enormous amount of talent, an enormous amount of patience, and you feel it in the art. Mm. You know, they managed to produce this kind of society.
They mixed art and technology in a way, Robert. That's the way I like it. They wove art and technology so much that you can't see where one finishes and the other ends.
Correct. And they didn't have this obsession with what we call progress.
Yeah.
So they learned to adapt rather than to change. And this is, you know, they had a land that operated in a certain way naturally, and they adapted to it rather than force the land to become what they wanted. And this is the totally different way of thinking, is to realize that we're not the changers of this planet. We are the people who must adapt. We must become evolutionary again in a social, cultural manner. I mean, I'm not suggesting we go and climb trees and become in the wild again. What I'm suggesting is that we need to rethink how we can deal with our natural world. And to me, the Egyptians are a model. They're there for us to examine and say, well, there are good things to take out of this. Mm-hmm. You know, this obsessions we have developed in our technological scientific society is leading us into trouble.
Sure. I have to ask you about this Mark Leonard guy. Is he still around? I know Zahi's gone. Whatever happened to this Mark Leonard guy?
I think he's ducking.
He's in hiding, is he?
Well, his problem was that, it's early days to look into the ins and outs of what really happened, because there's huge confusion. And it's not very clear yet. There's a whole cloud of smoke that needs to be cleared. However, what we do show in our book, since you started talking about this book, Breaking the Mirror of Heaven,
yeah,
is that there was a moment where, and especially starting from 2002, when Hawass did become the chairman of the antiquities, if you like, mm-hmm. and he was very, very involved with Mark Lynn. It is at that moment where suddenly comes another player in the game, and that's National Geographic. Those big television networks, National Geographic, Fox, which is part of National Geographic. And
just for the listeners, I should say, Robert, Mark Leonard became like a sidekick in a way. He was one of the theoretical sidekicks, and from that then...
Well, Mark Leonard has a very odd origin in his Egyptological career, as you know.
Which we expose in the book to Breaking the Mirror of Heaven. It's bizarre, his background.
Well, it's interesting to say the least, but the point is that by hook or by crook, both him and Hawass, bricked by those who pushed them in that direction, followed the Giza Necropolis, and they did. For a short while, they were the boss. You know, they're the ones who ran the show there. And boy, they were running the most important archaeological site in the world, mm-hmm. Where everybody wants to have a piece of the pie, you know, television sure. networks, journalists, explorers. I mean, this was the big thing, you know, mm-hmm. and of course, because of the door. Now, what happened is very interesting, because the opening of the door was held and held and held by Hawass until he became chairman. Suddenly, when he became chairman, he announced that they were going to have a live opening, which was, of course, the famous National Geographic show that was broadcasted, when was it, in September 2002, in the most hyped manner. And one has to realize the ins and outs of this.
Sure.
There was a huge, huge issue here. you know, a show like this announced, they started hyping the show 4 or 5 months before,
yeah.
where everybody wanted to know what was behind the door. There was this pent up excitement that had been going on for several years, and announcing a live opening of the door inside the Great Pyramid in the manner they did, which was broadcasted on Fox and national channels around the world, they were going to have a huge, huge audience. Apparently, it was estimated to over 1 billion viewers.
Me included. I was one.
Exactly. So if you have a 1 billion viewers rating, you're going to make a lot of money out of this. A lot of money. And they and the show, when they broadcast it live, had, if I remember well, at least 20 minutes of advertisement time. And it is rumored that they were paying for something like 15 seconds or 30 seconds, something like $5 million.
Wow.
For just, so you work it out. Now, I don't know the ins and outs. I haven't seen the accounts, but I can tell you because I've worked with television and I know the kind of arrangements that are made. So,
400 became, million, Robert.
Well, maybe less. I don't know. I'm saying that
at,
this is.
That's 5 million for 15 seconds. That's 400 million.
I don't know. I don't have the figures. All I can tell you is that
that's probably right. That's probably conservative. That's probably being conservative.
No, I think a figure of 100 million was thrown in. But having said this, this is what is very important to realize. And I think that this might break out one of these days. I'm very surprised it hasn't broken out. And we kind of try and highlight it as much as we can in the book, Breaking the Mirror of Heaven. Hawass, in order to do this, had to be chairman. The chairman could only give the okay on this with the Minister of Culture. This live show can only be done by those approvals.
Mm.
So it is interesting, to say the least, that the minute Hawass became chairman of the Antiquities, he passed on the exclusivity to the National Geographic, who had just appointed him as explorer in residence with a stipend of $200,000 a year.
Wow.
For life.
He sat on for life. Wow.
For life. Well, he, after the revolution, when this was pointed out, which is one of the reasons why he was kicked out, which infuriated the employees, realizing that he was getting that kind of stipend. But for life. And so he symbolically resigned. I'm not even sure if he's not still getting it. But that was the agreement at the time. This means that by the time the revolution came, which was 2011,
mm-hmm.
he had been in control with that stipend for nearly 10 years.
Wow.
He had received at least $200 million from the National Geographic alone.
Wow. So, he was in bed with everybody, wasn't he?
Well, look, all I'm saying is that if, you know, according to American law of dealing with foreign governments, whether you're a private company or the government itself, the American government, is you are definitely not allowed to coerce your position by either bribing or using influence by the foreign ministers or foreign individuals in the country.
Yeah.
Well, if that doesn't constitute influence, I don't know what does.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy gave him exclusivity when he was at the same time being offered a life stipend of $200,000 a year.
Wow.
And they did get exclusivity. They got exclusivity to do the biggest show on earth at the time. I mean, that was it. That was you can't imagine a more popular archaeological program shown on television, live opening of the door in the Great Pyramid. Having said this, it wasn't the only live show they did.
Mm.
There were several live shows that followed. There was which nobody paid attention. But this is what was happening. So Lehner was very much implicated with this. Lehner, in fact, was the one promoting the live show of the opening of the door severely around the world. I remember he even went to Australia. And Lehner was doing, and Hawass were doing together what before, when Gantebrink found the door, they were doing the opposite. When Gantebrink found the door, they said there's nothing there, there is no, it's just a block, we won't allow exploration. And now here they were promoting not just the live opening, and they were actually calling the secret chamber. If you remember, the program was called Secret Chamber. So if you called opening the secret chamber live, inside the Great Pyramid, you're going to get billions of viewers, right? I mean,
they were secretly, they were cashing in on the discovery, Robert. Call a spade a spade. That's what they did.
There was a lot of cash flowing about. Let's put it this way.
There was a lot of cash flowing about all the Russians.
The question is where it went is another matter. But what I'm saying is that, you know, suddenly their whole demeanor changed. You know, it's as if they were promoting the program. You know, Hawass was going saying, well, there might be the secret chamber, there might be the Khufu tomb, there might be the papyrus from you know, and they were throwing all these ideas.
Just generating hype.
Absolutely hype. I mean, even Lehner was doing it, which was very surprising because he was a very sober sort of individual when it came to that sort of hype. So, you know, it raised a lot of questions as to who was involved with who. And now that the revolution exploded and suddenly there is Hawass is under investigation and accused of, you name it, of diversion of funds, of there's a lot of unexplained activity.
Yeah.
Another one that came with National Geographic, which needs to be explained, is that Hawass, without presidential authority, which he required, both from the president and the minister of antiquities, to authorize and sign an agreement with National Geographic to take the Tutankhamun artifacts and go on a world tour, which they've been doing for over the last 7 years. He didn't have the authority to do that. He allowed the National Treasure to be taken by a private company, National Geographic, to tour around the world. And believe me, they were selling a lot of tickets. This has gone to I don't know how many countries, including England, Britain. So that's one of the main things that is being investigated as far as I know. But of course, in this mess of what's going on, it's been shelved.
Sure.
What I was very annoyed, among many other things, with the Muslim Brotherhood while they were in the presidency, is that suddenly Hawass, I don't know if you heard this 2 weeks ago, claimed that all the charges had been dropped.
Yeah.
That he was, the travel ban had been removed.
Yeah.
And off he was going to go and do his stuff and promote in Canada his, and here he is again screaming wildly this time that he believes that there is now the greatest ever discovery to be found behind his doors.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So there's something not right here. I hope that the new government is going to look very deeply into this because there's more than just Hawass who's messing around with these monuments. And I didn't like the idea of these exclusivities and these explorations. And suddenly, you know, the whole Egyptological world is not supporting the movement that that I and at the time with Gantebrick were promoting. We were saying, let's look into this. I mean, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know, here we have a man, Gantebrick, who found this important door. He's being pushed out. There's all this politics going around. We're still waiting for these doors to be open. As you know, they found another door.
That's right, yeah.
In 2002. We have no published
papers. Nothing.
Papers. We don't know what happened to the artifacts because we know that the copper handle of one of the Gantebrick door, as we call it, went missing. The wooden rods that were in the northern shaft have gone missing.
You would think in this day and age now, Robert, that like, I mean, people would put, like, I mean, there's no shortage of interest or money to go into ancient Egypt. Take any other culture or anything else. Nothing has what Egypt has. Everybody wants to go to Egypt and put interest and dig it up or look at it or analyze it. You know, there's no shortage of interest or money there. And it's such a slow, painful process, and it has been. Now,
well, sadly, James, it's unfortunately there is interest, but interest in the wrong hands.
True.
There's been a lot of people interested in making documentaries, in having exclusivity, and making a lot of money out of it. But it hasn't been with the right people, or at least the right people I consider the right people. You know, I got into trouble with this Gantebrick door because the whole thing went pear-shaped and I was accused of being the one who went to the press and I upset the Egyptian government.
This is why you're the baddie, Robert. You're the baddie.
Well, it's not like that at all. I know Egypt very well, and I knew that they were covering up this discovery, and I defended Ganterbrink, and I still do. Yeah. I wrote a whole book about this. You know, Ganterbrink was totally, it still is. I mean, the last time I spoke to Ganterbrink a few years ago, he was utterly and absolutely disgusted with what went on. I mean, he doesn't want to hear about the pyramid anymore. Sure. His good name was soiled by all these accusations. So all I did was to explore the shaft and found a door. I thought they would be excited. I thought they would hail me as an explorer. No, they accused me. They threatened me. They insulted me. They sued me. You know, so he doesn't want to know anything about it. This was an incredible story, and I think that, you know, all this mess that was fermenting at this antiquity department needs to be cleansed, and I don't think it's completely gone.
No.
You know, I am puzzled that Hawass is not behind bars, okay?
Yeah. Me too. I mean, I know the intricacies of what's gone on in the last 20 years. Pretty, not everybody does, obviously. Unless you follow the stories, it's difficult because a lot of it's going on behind the scenes and some of it's not. And you need to be a bit astute to figure some of it out, but.
There was a lot of outside influence.
A lot of it.
And I don't want to name names.
Sure.
But there was a lot of outside influence, and I'm not clear at all why and how this was allowed, and why and how this hasn't been exposed properly, and why and how those who messed around are still floating about freely. And at least we can name one, is Dr. Hawass.
Sure.
And since, to answer your question about Mark Lehner, at least he's been wise enough to duck.
Yeah.
You know, he's not showing his face anymore. I don't know. I mean, I've tried to Google and see where he is. I presume he's still at Boston University doing his thing. But Lehner, I think, was the innocent.
Yeah.
He followed the wrong path, to be honest with you. I think he got too much influenced by Zahi Hawass. Of course, Zahi had the keys to ancient Egypt, so he needed.
He seen it as an opportunity.
I know Lehner. I've met him many times, so I can say more about Lehner than I can say about Hawass. Every time I met Hawass, we argued, so I can't judge the man.
I don't like him, and I tell you why. I just don't like him one bit. And I tell you why. It's because what he did with Robert Schock, and Schock and John Anthony West were doing the Sphinx debate, and he was like, where's the potsherds of this mystery civilization, you know? And the difference is now that Göbekli Tepe is there, Robert, you know, and I'm glad to see that just for Dr. Schock's own, you know. I mean, Schock was disgusted when he came out with that. He just ignored all the evidence. No, and
Schock was like Ganterbrink in many ways, because yeah. It came as a surprise to him that here was he doing a proper scientific investigation, and the boy suddenly got slammed by all this politics and aggression and accusations. And so did I. I can tell you. I mean, when I published the Orion correlation theory, when I did the book, and then we had the BBC documentary, I was baffled. I had no idea that there was such aggression towards this new idea, which was also very scientific. I mean, I didn't suggest anything more than a scientific explanation. You know, it seemed to make a lot of sense to me to look at the astronomy, to look at the alignment of the pyramids and so forth. So there's nothing very extraordinary in terms of why they got so upset. I mean, to them, it's as if I insulted Egyptology, you know, as if I dragged it in a battlefield, you know, and that's how it was. I mean, I tell you, I usually say this, or I used to say this in my conferences. Suddenly every Egyptologist and every archaeologist wanted my blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and boy, there was a very vicious article.
A lot of emotions wrapped up in it, Robert, isn't it?
Well, I don't get it. You know, I really don't get it. I mean, it opened.
Ask us, you're from an engineering background.
Yeah,
I mean, like myself.
In fact, many of my colleagues don't get it. I mean, they say, why are they so upset? I mean, what's upset them? I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm not from Egyptology, or maybe, you know, and it seems to make so much sense, you know, and sure, if there is an older pedigree to ancient Egypt, what's so upsetting about that as well? On the contrary, Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful thing to know that civilization might be older, might be more sophisticated. We need to know, and there is nothing.
They could really cut.
There isn't political about it. No, I tell you what it is. It's, I don't know, but I mean the few that I've met. And I'm not including Professor Edwards. Professor Edwards, who was my mentor, by the way, was a lovely man who was very open to, and indeed promoted me. I mean, he was very pleased that outsiders were coming in. He was very friendly with Ganterbrig. Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't know this, but we met in Paris and with Ganterbrig, and it was great. All of us sitting around the table and talking about this exciting discovery and, you know, how everything might change if you find something inside the pyramid. And he himself didn't realize, although he was one of the most eminent Egyptologists, realized the pent-up political mess that became Egyptology of today.
Yeah.
You know, there is a lot of backstabbing, and I actually, the last Egyptologist I met was in Bulgaria a few weeks ago. I was invited by the Bulgarian national television to give an interview. You'll find it on my Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I was very pleased because my books have been published in Bulgarian, and they said, well, we want to do a 25-minute show, you know, on the national television on prime time. So I said, great, you know, I love it. Mm-hmm. So there I go. And of course, they had contacted the Egyptological Institute, and they brought this Egyptologist to sort of discuss. And there he goes again in the same old criticism. You know, Boval is a charlatan. Boval is not an Egyptologist. Boval doesn't know what he's talking about. And this is incredible.
Still,
you know,
on, still the mindset.
You know, so they were going on this very ad hominem attack, and then brought the famous, because the one, of course, they try to find criticism and try to argue against the theory. And one of them is the classical, you can take any three stars in the sky and any three buildings in Manhattan or in New York and fit them mm-hmm. to the stars. So this guy said the same old thing. He said, yo, I can take any three stars in the sky and fit them to three buildings in the town of Sofia, which is the capital of Bulgaria. So I counter-replied. I said, yeah, you can, but that's not the context. The context is very clearly related to the Orion correlation, yeah. The Orion constellation, and we have the shafts, we have the text, we have the alignments of the pyramid. You know, if you bring it.
What about the greater Orion correlation theory? Because they kind of, somebody else is, or is, have you anything to do with that? Somebody has said there's actually probably extra pyramids to the north and south.
Well, it depends how greater you want to take it. And, the point is very clearly made that there is an attempt to represent a sky region on the ground.
Yeah.
And I took it much further by, looking at the whole of Egypt, because I said if that's what they had in mind.
Maybe more. Maybe more.
Hence the title, by the way, Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, because Egypt was called by the Egyptians themselves as the mirror of heaven. And therefore, it looks like they saw the land as a kind of heavenly cosmic land. So if that was physically the case, then one would find other positions of temples and so forth. And I did write a whole book about this. Sure. And yes, it seems to respond to. Because if you take the 3,000 years of Egypt mm-hmm. in time, we have a civilization that at least lasted for 3,000 years. So we have a beautiful span of time. Mm. And we know that what changed, not just on the ground, where they moved around and built temples here and there and pyramids here and there, but the sky changed because of the precessional changes.
Yes.
And because of also the calendrical changes, you know, as you know, they had a calendar that drifted backwards and forward. So here you have things changing astronomically, and then you have things on the ground changing physically. So the idea was match both, see if they change at the same time. Mm-hmm. And amazingly, they do. They follow the rhythm of the sky, you know, the changes in activities, in position of temples, in alignments of temples, in also in theological ideologies, changes with the sky. It looks like they were following literally what they said they would follow. They would follow the cosmic order. They were dictated, if you like, by the changes of the sky.
Sure.
It was a kind of political astrology, if you like. Yeah. Call it what you like. But, and that is a magnificent way of looking at themselves, because they literally brought down the, and integrated their activity with this global cosmic activity. Mm-hmm. In other words, they felt part of it.
Sure.
And they're not wrong. We are part of it, whether we like it or not.
Whether we like it or not. Robert, I got to jump in there because I have to mention your other two books. That's why you're here today, to also mention what's coming up in the future. So we just reviewed The Breaking the Mirror of Heaven. It's an awesome book, and it's a very significant book. And I think what you do say in the book is that you endorse the sovereignty of the Egyptian people, but it's probably not the best time to bring all the antiquities back there. You know, it's good, and it's all eyes are on Egypt at the moment. Like, you know.
Yes, I think what we wanted to do with this book as a conclusion is to sound an alarm.
Yeah.
We wanted the world to look again properly at what's going on there. And we exposed the problems. And the problems are not new, by the way, as you probably realize in the book. There's been a lot of destruction. Much of ancient Egypt was destroyed in the last 200 years.
Yeah.
Not in antiquities. You know, temples, cities were removed because there was the wrong people in charge of Egypt. And we have to be extremely careful that this doesn't happen again, because the last thing we want is for a further destruction. We lost a lot. And Egypt is a memory. Egypt is the memory of our origins. You know, it's there for us to examine and to study. So it would be a real drama if we don't pay attention to what's going on. So having said this, sure, Let's talk about the other books.
Now, well, I'm glad we got into that today. And I have been looking at the politics for a while, so it was great to have that chat too, Robert. It really was. So you have this new book, Imhotep, the African Architect of the Cosmos. I'm really intrigued with this. This looks, it's new, it's exciting. You're talking about this guy, Imhotep. Let's talk about him. You talk about him as an ancient Egyptian superstar. Yeah.
Yes, and he's been made a superstar of Hollywood as well. You know, Imhotep name is even more popular nowadays than Tutankhamun.
Mm.
Of course, all distorted by Hollywood, but okay, Imhotep in his proper context was a genius that happened to be born at the time of what we call the Third Dynasty. And we know for sure, this is the most exciting thing about Imhotep and his legacy, is that we know for sure that he was the high priest of Heliopolis, which gave him an enormous influence on the pharaonic state. He was like the pope, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that his role was very cosmic. He was a kind of super astrologer, if you like, that advised the pharaoh on the law, on what was happening in the sky and what needed to be done on the ground. He was the man, if you like. And he happened to be the very first architect. This is another exciting thing. We know for sure that he designed and supervised the construction of the Saqqara complex, Step Pyramid complex.
Sure.
So the idea came, and let's find out who this man is, because we know very little other than his name. Now, we know how later they turned him into some sort of god, and even much later the Greeks made him into the god of medicine and so forth.
Mm.
But we said, okay, where did he get his knowledge from? You know, where does this... Okay, he was a genius, but suddenly, how does he know about geometry and architecture and astronomy and all these wonderful things that is expressed in his design? So we thought, well, if our theory is correct, that we put forward in Black Genesis, then maybe he or his ancestors or his family had a link with these prehistoric people, these people who came from the desert and settled and brought their cargo of knowledge into the Nile Valley.
Mm.
I don't want to go too much into that.
Yeah.
But the approach to Imhotep the African, which the title says it all, mm-hmm, was that in order to read him, in order to read his mind, we analyzed his design. And all, as all architects today will say, if you want to analyze architects like Christopher Wren and Bernini and all these wonderful, great architects of history, well, luckily we have texts and letters from them, but if we didn't have this, we would look in their design. What did they think when you examine what they designed, the symbolism, the alignments, and so forth? And the Sakkale Acropolis is a perfect book, if you like, to do this. And what comes out of it is extremely interesting, which I won't tell you now because we want you to read the book.
Sure, and that's coming out in the fall, this fall, Robin.
It's coming out in September.
September, beautiful.
Yes. Yes, it's already advertised on Amazon. It's co-authored with Tom Brophy. We really got very excited with this one because we began to realize that the door that we opened to look at the origins of Egyptian civilization as being an African origin, but being a very sophisticated one, because clearly the knowledge that was expressed in the design of Imhotep is a very sophisticated one, much more than previously thought. When you read the book, you will see that when you analyze the Saqqara complex, as I did for Giza in my previous books, what comes out of it is an amazing knowledge of what you actually said, a kind of blend between art and science. Yeah. But it has a message. It has a message, and it throws us, like Giza did, into a distant date. Mm-hmm. And I'll just say this. Surprisingly, it throws us to the date of Nabta Playa. It throws us back there. So it's very clear that Nabta Playa is a kind of embryonic moment of civilization.
Yeah, I'd watched the documentary. I can't remember. Oh, could have well been the Pyramid Code. I can't remember, but you were getting quite passionate and disheartened with nobody was protecting Nabta Playa. I know you're a very passionate person, Robert, and you're very passionate about the history and stuff, but it's been such neglected, that Nabta Playa.
Well, James, I went there many times, and the last time we got involved with Nabta Playa was a very, very sad thing, because, and there you are, bringing Hawass. I mean, he made the wrong decision. He made the wrong decision to remove much of the megalithic stones and take them to the Nubian Museum for display. You know, it's like taking Stonehenge and taking it to the...
Really?
Because then they become stones, you know, if they're not in their original location with their alignments. Luckily, we had satellite imagery and maps that retain the original layouts.
That's insane, Robert.
Well, it's because he didn't understand what it was, you know, and there you are. I mean, if you're looking, like John West said, if you're looking for potatoes in a diamond field, you won't see the diamonds.
Yeah.
You know, it's not stones. It's stones.
It's alignment.
Well, it's like saying the Great Pyramid is a heap of stones, you know. Well, of course it isn't. It is something else. It's the ideas behind this, and that's what Nabta Playa was. Nabta Playa was a window to our prehistoric origins. And it gave us this wonderful leftover message to try and understand our human origins, because ideas are incorporated in the layout of the stones. And to move them, to me, was criminal, literally criminal. If I was going to charge Hawass with anything, it would be this. Because I went to see the stones at the museum. And in fact, nobody goes and see them. They don't even know it's there, because they lost their... They lost their meaning, if you like. It's just stones in a yard. They put them outside, you know, in a yard.
I think that could have been a strategic thing, because they don't want to talk about pre-dynastic.
I think it's just plain stupidity, honestly.
It's just stupidity, Robert.
Yeah, well, a bit of both, but mostly stupidity. And I tell you what, I was very upset, because I did write to UNESCO, and nothing really happened. I mean, it's just very sad. And we're trying, and that's in Black Genesis, the book I wrote with Brophy, and again in Imhotep the African, we're sounding the alarm, because there's a lot of that evidence still in the Egyptian Sahara, particularly in Gilf Kebir, these faraway regions, and Uwainat. Yeah. I went to Uwainat with Tom Brophy in 2008. I can tell you, it's like landing on planet Mars. I mean, it's an alien world that was inhabited by our ancestors.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunately left unguarded, unprotected, And sadly, we keep hearing of desecration and people going there without permits and messing about with the rock art. So this is the alarm we sent, this is the laboratory, the natural laboratory to understand our origins. So is Göbekli Tepe. Unfortunately, it's, or was in the wrong hands. Let's hope it gets into the right hands. That's why partly we write these books. And you say of course we're passionate, because we saw these things firsthand.
Sure. I'm really intrigued with this book. You call Imhen Hotep, Imhen Hotep, you call him a Da Vinci, Michelangelo, Galileo, and Newton all rolled into one. So,
sorry, you're getting, well, he was Da Vinci, and Newton all rolled into one. But he left us, and it's there. This is the beauty of his legacy. It's been misunderstood, and what Brophy and I tried to do, we're using the language that was in his mind, astronomy, or sacred astronomy, if you like. That's the best word, sacred astronomy. And we're trying to make him speak again. And that's what Imhotep the African is we're giving a voice to this genius that has left us his legacy.
Sure. Okay, Robert, I want to touch on the other book as well, because next year, early next year, you got The Vatican Mystery, The Quest for the Hermetic City of the Sun, and you can actually pre-order copies of this, I believe. And why the change to the Vatican, Robert? Where did this come about? This is a different direction for you, no?
Well, strangely, no. The change in direction is, let me put it very briefly. The architect Bernini, whom everybody has heard of these days because of the books of Dan Brown, Angel and Demons, I think it's sure. What he talked. Well, Bernini was commissioned, was the architect of the papacy, and he was commissioned by Pope Alexander VII in 1656, precisely, to design the famous Piazza St. Peter. And what happened really was that there was an empty plot of land in front of the new Vatican that exists today, the one that you see today. And there was an ancient Egyptian obelisk bang in the middle of this plot of land, which had been brought there 50 years before and which had been somewhere else in Rome nearby. Hello?
Hello? Can you hear me? Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you get all this?
Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah.
Yes. And, anyway, to cut this long story short, when Bernini came to design the piazza, there was the obelisk and there was something else. This is what makes it very interesting. Mm. Adjacent to the obelisk was a fountain that had been put there some 15 years before by the previous papal architect called Maderno. He's the one who designed the facade of the new Vatican. Now, what Bernini did was to design an ellipse, and he used the obelisk as the center of that ellipse. All right? Now, and he used the fountain as one of the focal points. As you know, the ellipse has two focal points on each side of its center. So the obelisk was the center, and there was one fountain. Later on, much later, they put a second fountain. But when Bernini came, he used that single fountain to draw his ellipse. Now, to any astronomer, an ellipse with one focal point immediately evokes the first law of planetary motion of Kepler.
Kepler's laws, yeah.
That's it, point blank. So the question is, did Bernini know this? Did the Pope know this? And were there astronomers with Bernini at the time who would have certainly known this? And it turns out, and I don't want to go into too much detail,
sure,
that there were four astronomers working with Bernini at the time, major astronomers. One of them was actually the Pope's confessor, so he was right there. He was a Jesuit astronomer called Nicola Zucchi. He's actually a man who actually met Kepler, and he is well known for having gifted Kepler with the first telescope.
Wow. In fact,
so there was no question that this astronomer not only knew Kepler's law, but was right there at the Vatican because he was the confessor of the Pope and a very, very good friend of Bernini. Wow. There was another astronomer called Athanasius Kircher, who had been involved with Bernini for a long time, moving obelisks in various places of Rome. There was a third astronomer that makes it very interesting, who happened to be, believe it or not, the Queen of Sweden. The Queen of Sweden, it's a long story, but she converted to Catholicism, was brought to Rome, and became a kind of Queen of Rome. She became a buddy-buddy of Bernini at exactly that time. They were friends for a lifetime. But she had been educated. She was a kind of Cleopatra of her age. She had been educated in Sweden before she came to Rome, mm-hmm. by no less than René Descartes. René Descartes, the famous physicist, astronomer.
Yes.
Yes. He actually died in her court, by the way. Oh. Very strange story. She spoke 8 languages. She was like Cleopatra. She was highly educated and had a particularly strong interest in astronomy. She corresponded with Gazendi, the astronomer royal of France. And so there was no question that the people involved in the design knew of Kepler's planetary law of motion. So the big question is why? What's it about? Why did they do it?
There's a bombshell there, isn't it?
Well, because it was supposed to be a heresy. And why I got interested in this before it led me to this conclusion is because at the time, behind all this, was the Hermetic tradition. The philosophers of Italy, particularly in Florence, had discovered ancient Egyptian texts that they believed were important texts to be incorporated in Catholicism. And these texts spoke about a reformation. They spoke about, well, I don't want to go into that, but what is very interesting is that they finally inspired a philosopher.
Yeah.
I'm talking for a long time here. A philosopher called Tommaso Campanella. Tommaso Campanella wrote a book called The City of the Sun. And that makes the whole thing very interesting because Tommaso Campanella's book is about creating a utopian city, which he tried to convince the papacy to do, to become a kind of world headquarter for Catholicism using solar theologies based on the Egyptian theologies. It sounds crazy, but it's true.
Wow.
What happened was Tommaso had been actually accused of heresy many years before in the 1600s, very early 1600s, and was in the papal dungeon when the trial of Galileo was taking place. And of course, the trial of Galileo was totally against the heliocentric theory, and that's when Pope Urban VIII made it a heresy. Well, believe it or not, Pope Urban VIII, who was the man responsible for the trial of Galileo, himself was going through a nervous breakdown. Believe me, we did a huge research on this. I have a professor in Rome who...
You couldn't make this stuff up yourself, Robert.
No. This is properly documented. But however, he was having a nervous breakdown. The reason he was having a nervous breakdown was that a prediction had been made by astrologers, Spanish astrologers, that he was going to die at the next solar eclipses. One was going to take place in 1628, and one was taking place in 1630. So he hears about this philosopher, Tommaso Campanella, who not only wrote The City of the Sun, but had claimed in a book, written in jail, that he could counteract these astrological inevitable predictions. So the Pope has him taken out of jail, brought to the Vatican, and they perform, believe it or not, several months, if not years, of magic in order to counter out this astrology that was supposedly going to kill the Pope. And that's when this Campanella convinces, or nearly convinces, the Pope of building this famous City of the Sun.
Wow.
Ironically, this philosopher, for various reasons you'll find in the book, had to escape to France, and he convinced the solar king of France to do that. Strange enough, when this is going on in France, now, I don't know if you've read Talisman, but this is one of the big points, that sure. Paris seems to be designed in solar alignments and so forth. Mm. But following that, 30 years later, after the trial of Galileo, when all astronomers began to accept Kepler's planetary law of motion, the heliocentric theory became accepted, the only ones who were blocked in accepting this were the Italian scientists, particularly the Jesuits, who were all astronomers, mostly astronomers and physicists. They had this huge problem, is that the papacy set on this heresy. But they had another plan, and that plan, I will leave it a bit, I won't tell you now, because...
Okay, no, well, that leads up to the rest of the book, Robert. But,
oh, yeah, yeah. because the plan is what is interesting. Because now we have a Jesuit Pope, by the way.
Yeah.
And it looks like the plan is taking shape.
Wow.
It's a very, very curious thing. And it's extremely well researched. It's one of my favorite researchers because I worked with two Italian scholars. We did this huge, enormous, in-depth research with documents at the Vatican and you name it. And what comes out of it is even stranger than the Orion correlation theory.
Wow. Well, sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction, as they say, Robert.
I think so. You know, one has to look at big movements that are going on, and the world is in a very strange situation now. We have democracy that is desperately trying to globalize the world. We have the Islamic uprising, and then we have this Pope coming in.
Yeah. The it's question is, change the dynamics. It's all going in all directions, isn't it?
Yeah. The question is, who's going to win?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I think you've covered most of.
We got the idea, Robert. Robert, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. It really has. And,
it was a pleasure being on your show, James. And, it was always nice to have an interview who lets me go on and on because that's the way I like it.
For sure, Robert. But listen, Robert, give us out your webpage before you go. And if you have any tours coming up, please plug them in.
Yes. Well, my webpage is robertboval.co.uk. My tour, I have a tour coming in September, but of course we're waiting to see how things develop, but it's advertised on this web page. I have already people who have booked, but we're kind of holding back a little bit. Although personally, I think that I wouldn't be surprised if everything is more or less back to normal within a few weeks.
Sure.
I don't think this situation can persist, and there's no question now that the interim government of Egypt and the military do not want to turn back. They're looking forward to bringing Egypt on track. So I think it'll be okay. But of course, I run these tours every year, so keep on checking.
Yep. RobertBoval.co.uk. Well, again, Robert, it's been a pleasure having you on the show.
It's been a pleasure, James. Thank you.